Education is so important, yet many educators must begin to think and teach differently in order to inspire social impact. One of the things I think educators must do is to help students move from theory to practice. Educators must show students how to take what they've learned in the classroom and apply it to real life.
Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Another thing I think teachers should be doing more of is teaching students the importance of social responsibility and being engaged in solving social challenges in their communities, nation, and world. And as an Afro-Latinx scholar committed to justice work, that is what Dr. Dalia Antonia Caraballo Mueller does. She has always framed her teaching around social, racial, and environmental justice. But she realized at a certain point that teaching justice content does not prepare students to do justice work. She felt like she needed a more radical approach. So she developed a learning practice that braids critical thinking, critical self-reflection, engagement, and activism in a unique way. And she calls this practice the Impossible Project. And so today I'm happy to have a conversation with a Dr. Caraballo Mueller about the Impossible Project. Dr. Dalia Antonia Caraballo Mueller is the Associate Professor of Latin American and Caribbean History at the University of Buffalo, SUNY Hispanic Leadership, and she's also the SUNY Hispanic Leadership Institute Fellow and founder of the Impossible Project. Welcome, Dr. Dalia, to the Empowerment Zone. I'm happy to have you here. How are you today?
Thank you very much. I'm well. I'm very well. I appreciate being here with
you. Yes. Well, thank you for accepting the invitation to be on the Empowerment Zone. We're really excited about hearing about the Impossible Project. But before we get there, can you tell our audience a little bit about you and your background?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in New York City as a multiracial, multicultural Afro-Latina. I really appreciate this entry and this question, because as I've been thinking about it, very much my identity as being in between places and spaces, a kind of unsettled identity, I would say, is really foundational to both my research work and my pedagogical work. So I've been meditating on that a little bit and on those early years in middle school and high school, and thinking about the specific experience of growing up multiracial and multicultural. And you know what? It was actually a little bit painful in the beginning. In seventh, eighth grade, I remember I had my Black friends telling me I was not Black. I had my white friends telling me that they either saw me as other, or alternatively, super interesting, like claiming me and like erasing my difference. And then I was thinking that I had my white presenting or white identifying Latinx friends that could not understand why I was not making a bigger effort to claim whiteness, right? Mm-hmm, like that mm-hmm, was, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Oh, you don't know, you just have to straighten your hair and you can totally pass. Like mm-hmm. They couldn't understand. And so when I was reflecting on this, or I've been reflecting on this recently, I was thinking that I spent most of my youth with people telling me who I was and who I was not. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And so I thought that actually is the seed of my work, because I tend to write about, in my research, folks that are either in transition or out of place. You know what I'm saying? And so I think in some ways I'm sort of grappling with that, with my own journey, you know, through the research work and through a lot of my commitments, both within the university and outside the university.
So you talk about being Afro-Latina. What is your ethnic cultural heritage and background that you claim both of those identities?
Yeah, well, my father's family are Black Puerto Ricans. you know, proud, identified, et cetera. And my mom's family is white, born in Spain and of diverse European heritage. So I am like a straight, you know, sort of, so I consider myself, so often sometimes multiracial, but I grew up actually talking about myself as biracial because having a white mother and a black father, that's what I had. But then I had the layer of the fact that my, that the black side of my family was Puerto Rican, right? Speaking of Latinx. So, so yeah, so that's how I came up, but didn't really fit anywhere. Consequently, you know, it didn't make sense to folks, right? There's, you know, these buckets that were meant to fit in. I like to think that nowadays with kids coming up, it's a little bit different, hopefully. But
yeah, you know, I always say, you know, it's not important about how others define us, but how we define ourselves. And, you know, identity is such a personal journey and it's an evolutionary process. It's not stagnant, it's fluid. And so it's empowering to hear how you said, oh, I didn't fit anywhere, but now I know where I fit. You know, I know who I am, in other words.
Yeah, I think a little part of me is just constantly telling those, I mean, not quite bullies, but those folks from seventh through ninth grade, like, you know, stop trying to pinpoint me, fit me in a box, you know, but you had to, you know, you had to come up and that's a struggle, right? You had to own that. Right. And so for a long time, didn't necessarily feel like that was something I could really do. You know, you get pulled in one other direction you think you need to fit, but sort of owning that as a strength, like a position for speak and to think and to work is, yes, a journey, but it's great.
So tell us, along your personal journey, you stated that it has really informed, your personal journey has informed your professional journey, which that's all of us, right?
Yeah, right.
And so we're here to talk about the Impossible Project. So tell us about the Impossible Project.
Yeah, awesome. I will. As I mentioned, I'm a professor at university. I'm an historian. I've been working as a university professor for 11 years, a little bit over that, maybe. And you know, I am, my work is, as I mentioned, is always about people in between, people out of place, and always about justice, right? So the work that I do as a researcher, but then also the work I do in my classroom with my students is all about, is all about informing them about justice movements in the past, right? So injustice and justice and efforts to rectify injustice in the past. But then I started to think in my own classroom, right? How can I do more with my students, right? Is it enough for them just to learn about it, right? How do we get them to actually experience justice work, make that part of who they are, right? And I know a lot of my colleagues that try to do this kind of work or think through this in their classroom. So for me, the Impossible Project was about really connecting my research work, the lessons I'm learning from the past, and to be able to transfer those to my students, not just sort of through their ears, as it were, right? Kind of activating their minds, but getting them to be able to make that connection and engage in justice work. And so the Impossible Project then is like a learning practice that I do in my own classrooms and that I do collaboratively with colleagues across many different disciplines, always focused on just activating students for justice work. And so, you know, right now it started out as just a project in my classroom and now being delivered to over 700 students across 4 to 5 disciplines and programs within my university alone, with some excitement from colleagues outside of my university at different places. So I'm hoping to see the project grow. So it's not properly an organization yet. We might go in that direction. But right now it's really an organic project between educators, right? Generally at the university level, working with students. But I like to think that because the Impossible Project is something that can be activated in any learning space, that it can be used by community educators, it can be used outside of the university, it can be used in K through 12 classrooms as well.
So tell us about what you actually have your students do as they are involved in these justice projects.
Yeah. Okay. So I could do a couple of different examples in my own classroom right now. As an historian, I'm teaching a couple of classes. One I'll mention is actually a course on Afrofuturism that looks at how, especially how Afrofuturist artists, thinkers, writers draw on the past in order to inform the present. So because it's a history class, we get to delve into the past and understand the Black past, as it were, diasporically, But then we look at the creative projects of Afrofuturist artists and writers and look at how they reappropriate the past and why. So that's really exciting. It's really challenging because I'm getting my students to think historically and to engage with histories that have been erased or denied or minimized, right? So there's like a growth edge there where they wake up and they realize, oh man, I didn't learn about this in high school. Right? These are freshmen, first years. Mm-hmm. Oh, why wasn't this on my high school curriculum, right? So there's a growth edge there. But then what we also do is we partner with an Afrofuturist organization locally called the Galactic Tribe. They're a really awesome organization that works with Black and Brown youth in the city of Buffalo, especially empowering Black and Brown youth to imagine the future, the Afro future, and construct it. So we partner with them in a really fantastic way. My students go out in the community, they come into the classroom, and we're building out original resources for them based on our own historical excavations and study that have an Afrofuturist component, right? That have an opportunity for those students to actually take the real past that we're studying, but then sort of invite community participants to imagine a different future from that past, right? And so that's really nice because we're trying to sync in with the community education work that these folks in the Galactic Tribe are doing. We're really honoring their work. But my students in the academy are also really learning about a past that they haven't had access to, right? But so in the process of doing it, I tell my students, like, you are building a part of the Afro future. Like, you are doing that work because you're not only learning about it, sort of decolonizing your own, like interrogating the ways in which and the reasons why you will know this history, but then you're activating yourselves by taking that history and bringing it out to the community and working with community folks to share in that knowledge, right? Like, so that's the way we're going to take the step forward. And the students are taking it incredibly seriously, and they're motivated, right? Because this isn't just another class to, you know, tick off the list. This now is an experience that is profound, right?
And that's how education is transformative, is moving from theory to practice. Yeah. So when you look at for our audience, can you please define Afrofuturism for people who are new to this concept?
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's the subject of my students' first paper. And they were pretty upset at me because the first thing I said is, I can give you this as a paper topic because it is not a one answer, a one sentence answer, right? Mm-hmm. So Afrofuturism is defined so many different ways, but I am particularly intrigued with the ways in which Afrofuturism draws on the past critically and creatively to envision the Afro future, right? Or a future without oppression. And I think that that would be considered differently in different times. Like, some folks will situate the origins of Afrofuturism with like the first enslaved folks that were brought over from Africa, right? 500 years ago, et cetera. So like there's this very old story. And they will say some of those first folks were Afrofuturists, right? Because part of the work of surviving out of and in response to dislocation required you to every day imagine yourself into the future more positively, right? Mm-hmm. Folks, you'll say Harriet Tubman was an Afrofuturist. I mean, you can, right? So it's a very expansive idea. But to me, what it's most effectively anchored in is this idea of drawing, is sort of taking an eyes wide open look at the past, drawing from the past in order to construct a future free of oppression, right? And that's, in fact, ends up needing to be all intersecting forms of oppression. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. a very idealistic view of the future, but, you know, some folks would say that, you know, if Black, in a world in which Black women are free, everyone's got to be free.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
All the interlocking oppressions have to go.
Yes.
So that's what resonates most with me.
So when you look at the Impossible Project and the students working with the Galactic Tribe, what kind of challenges are you all addressing?
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, the mission of the tribe is to empower, you know, Black and Brown youth in the city of Buffalo, right? In some of our poorest neighborhoods. So, you know, these are youth that are potentially struggling in school, not in school, right? Really just trying to like make ends meet. And so one of the things that we shared, and I shared in a conversation with a couple of tribe members who are the leaders of the organization, is that our youth are really beaten down and really apathetic. And one of the things not by fault of their own. And one of the things that they were saying that really resonated with me and that we connected on is the need to be able to open up the space to dream, right? That in order to be able to dream, you need a certain amount of space, right? You need a full belly.
Totally agree.
I'm saying like, and so just thinking about, you know, in the absence, like while we're working on justice and equality and rights and bare necessities and all of that, like that is absolutely essential work. That is important work. But at the same time, we're collectively, me with my college students, them with the folks in the community that they're working with, trying to figure out how do we authorize people or get them to authorize themselves to dream, right? We need that to be able to move forward. And so I think that's the biggest challenge is actually allowing people or getting them to allow themselves to be creative, right?
So how are you as an educator creating that environment? You said people don't have, people don't have a space to dream. How are you creating the environment where they can have a space?
Yes. Well, it's by resignifying the classroom, right? And really radically resignifying the classroom because our classrooms are structured in particular ways. Mm-hmm. And even we folks who are in the humanities, not to mention folks that are in the hard sciences, right? We come to the classroom, a couple of things, right? One, we come to the classroom, forgive me, colleagues out there, we come unprepared and untrained, right? Because we all went through grad school and nobody taught us how to teach. Mm-hmm. And in fact, most major professors told us, don't worry about it, right? Mm-hmm. Do your research, the rest will come. Mm-hmm. And so we're underprepared, I would say, as a faculty to help our students do that. And so we also then, you know, we might add in our little diversity piece here. We might, you know, kind of make our syllabi more complicated. We try to be more inclusive. But I think what we miss is that the academy itself and our classrooms are already structured in ways that advantage certain students, right, and disadvantage others. And until we interrogate that and sort of pull that apart and lay it bare, we can't make change. So in the Impossible Project, that's the first thing we do, right? I try to upend the classroom to almost make it unrecognizable for my students to come in, right? I'm not the professor that they expect me to do. I'm not going to be giving them information they get to regurgitate, right? I'm going to disrupt that security. Mm-hmm. No, it's not going to work. If I give you the information, you give it back to me on the test as I want it, you get the A. That's not how my classroom works, right? So it's about really radically shifting how the classroom feels as a space, right? And that by doing that, we can actually make our classrooms spaces that are actually truly more inclusive of folks for whom they are not made, right? Like Black and Brown folks and folks that are in other ways non-normative, right? Or considered disadvantaged in the classroom space. So I try to really reframe that and bring my students into community and into collaborative thinking, collaborative research and collaborative work and work with me in ways that look really unfamiliar. And that has been really, really effective for my students.
So give us some examples for those educators out there who want to restructure, reshape, reimagine the way they teach in the class and they want to reimagine their classrooms. What are some ideas that you have for them?
Yeah. All right. So I would say, first off, it does start with being willing to be critical and thoughtful about yourself as an educator, right? Spending a little bit of that time with yourself to think about what do I do? How do I do it? What do I, you know, in what ways am I being inclusive and supportive of all of my students? But taking a real hard look at that, not being afraid to take a look at that, right? Because we're all, I mean, I could tell you some of the mistakes I've made. I mean, we've all made mistakes, but I think first it begins with the educator and the willingness to, again, take that self-critical look. Mm-hmm. Second, it requires, you know, really retooling your syllabus in a way that, so that what you're teaching is not, you know, your standard work, the standard content that you deliver, plus let me add on a diversity week, right? You know, in history, it's kind of, you know, clear, right? I'm going to teach, kind of, if it's a Latin American modern class, yep, I'm going to teach a standard story, but I'm going to like fit in Black folks here and there and there, you know, but to actually be daring enough to kind of really, you know, and that can be a follow-up to that self-critical work as you think about, you know, how am I shaping the whole curriculum? So that already does a ton of work. When you bring your students in the classroom, what I do is I also disrupt the sort of traditional student-teacher relationship, right? So again, I am not the giver of knowledge and the students are not the receivers of knowledge, right? I try to invite my students so that they are creating knowledge alongside alongside me in the process, right? And then maybe lastly, I would say how I get my students to work together, right? So I try to not think about students coming together as group work, right? So I think not additive, not a bunch of individuals coming together to do a project. They each put in their bit and they hand it to me, right? Or they all do their presentation, but I think of transformative. What does it take to do, to bring students together so that the work they do together is transformative of those students, right? But I call that true collaboration. And I try to stay away from conceptualizing group work as group work. So I think if you make that shift and you start thinking, what would it do? How could I structure my group work with my students? How could I structure this collaboration that I ask my students to do in a way that is transformative? What would that look like?
Right. That's a great way to look at collaborative work, is to approach it in a different different type of way. So, you know, when you look at the Impossible Project, how do you feel your the project is valuable to both African-American and Latinx communities?
Yeah, well, I think probably in two ways that are interlocking, right? Because I think the project tackles inequality in classrooms and injustice globally, right? So it's it working at these interlocking levels. So for me, what I had mentioned before in a sort of 5-point strategy for upending your classroom, right? Like I said, I think the classroom that you will have at the end of that process is one in which you should be able to see Black and brown students existing in that classroom probably differently from how they've existed in your classrooms before. So I think the first thing that, like, the measure for me is that I need that, like, not one Black or brown student drops my class. Not one Black or brown student fails my class, right? Like, those are my metrics, right? Those are my assessments. And so am I creating a learning space? Because, like, you know, for the most part, my white male and white female students do pretty well. You know, everybody has life issues. And of course, there's a range. But there's a very strong distinction between how Black and brown students will do in my classes, right? And so for me, being able to see that all my students are able to thrive, that means I'm doing something right. But I specifically pay attention to my Black and brown students in the classroom and their success and the way in which they are able to be or have the opportunity to be transformed through the work, right? So I would say that's one. And the other is just that the project's always oriented toward justice work, generally racial justice, always social justice, sometimes planetary justice as well. So for me, I'm trying to put out folks in the world, you know, through university who are global citizens oriented towards justice. And so I'm saying to these folks, you can do whatever you want. You could be a software engineer, you could be a businessman, whatever it is. But I want you to carry this lesson with you, right? And I want you to know and to think about and to feel responsible for being a global citizen in this world, working for social good and for justice in this world, right? Like, that's what I'm trying to do. So I feel very powerfully that I'm able, that I've already been successful in doing that with my students.
Yeah, and that makes your work as an educator even more impactful when you have your students who actually embrace social responsibility. And no matter what type of work they do, like you stated, whether they choose to be a banker or whatever profession they choose, that they know that social responsibility should be a part of their obligation and responsibility as a global citizen. So do you work with any other African-American or Latino organizations? You did mention the Galactic Tribe.
Yeah. Well, I have to give a shout out to Devon McCune and Anthony Pierce, who are two of the team of four that created that organization, which is now a formal nonprofit doing really amazing work. So I definitely want to shout them out. You know, I think what's really nice is that the collaboration with them, with so community educators, community leaders, who are also connected to some of the most important larger nonprofits looking at housing equity here in the city. You know, I think of these relationships not as a one-off, right? Like when I came to propose a relationship with them, I said, let's do this year. And next year, I'm going to have a team of graduate students and we can deepen this work, right? So I'm trying to show them I'm not wasting your time. I'm not taking up your time just for this one experience, and then I'm not just extracting from you your community expertise, but not really giving you anything valuable in return.
Right.
That's also a commitment of mine, right? We do that too much at the university and too carelessly. Mm-hmm. And so we're in it for the long haul, which is what I kind of love about the, it's not just the relationships I'm forming, but the kind of relationships and the way I'm forming them intentionally. I also work with educators right now. I'm working with two African-American teachers in the K-12 schools who are holding it down, right? Supporting our, you know, Black and Brown youth in middle school classrooms. And they're working with my students as well, right? And I expect to be able to work with those teachers as we go forward, you know, providing resources for the public schools as well that teachers can draw on to bring more diverse lessons into their classroom, into their curriculum. And it's not so much that these young men, I'll shout them out too, Aunt Sharon Jackson and Mr. Anthony White, it's not that they can't do this research on their own, but as you know, right, the life of the school teacher, you know, is very rigorous, is very demanding. And so my classroom, my students, we're trying to just offer some very usable resources for these excellent teachers while they're out in the field. So I'm very passionate about staying connected to our public school system. That's another one. And then I'm actually have a big computing project. And so right now we're in the middle of it, but I'm looking at building connections with folks in computing, both practitioners and theoreticians who are interested in race discrimination in computing, right? Because we're hoping to graduate some justice-oriented computer scientists because mm-hmm. we know we need those folks out in the field. So I'm right now working to build up some community connections and hopefully some further afield in that sector as well.
You know, that's some great work. And you had an excellent point about people in higher education going into the community and really being more of takers than givers. And yeah. that we really, really need to do more about giving to the community as we continue to promote higher education mm-hmm. and, do our research. We also need to give at the same time. So yeah. when you look at social responsibility, what would you like to see African Americans and Latinos doing more of in the area of social responsibility?
Yeah. Wow, that's a big one. I mean, you know, from my vantage point as an educator, I mean, I guess I would be sort of thinking about the subset of us that are Black and Latinx and Afro-Latinx within the academy. You know, I'd hope all of the folks that I reach out to, and so far this has been true, are embracing or have already embraced at some level this kind of mission in their work. Mm-hmm. Because I think, I mean, I don't believe that it should be our responsibility alone, but I think the responsibility of supporting Black and Brown students that come into the university and making sure they make it through and out, right? That's everything. That is so, so important. And there are a lot of things that could be done at a broader level at the university, but like as a faculty, we're the front line, right? And I feel that that's really, really something that we have to embrace. You know, it's hard for me to think about the kinds of things that I would say out to youth in the community struggling with so many of the things that they're struggling with. You know, my words would be more words of inspiration, mm-hmm. right? You know, and the same kind of inspirational words I would give to folks in the academy, students in the academy that are struggling, right? Which is you need to find your people, you need to find your mentors, your supporters, and you need to continue to work hard despite the adversities that are out there, right? Because we need you as leaders in the community, mm-hmm. right? And so my mind would just be about lift and encouragement for folks.
Yeah, you have a great point in terms of the role and responsibility of African-Americans and Latinos in the academy in ensuring that Black and Brown students not only get into college, but that mm-hmm. they complete college. And a lot of times we can do a lot more in terms of recruitment, retention yeah. and helping people to matriculate through the process in order that they complete college. It's not good enough to just go. We need right. you to finish, as you stated, yeah. So that you can go out and continue to do that great community work and mm-hmm. be leaders in the community. Yeah. So do you have any calls to action in it for our audience in terms of how they can be more impactful in social responsibility or what they can do in terms of supporting your work in the Impossible Project.
Yeah. Well, in terms of supporting more, my work is, you know, is reach out to me on the website and start collaborating. I mean, I give talks, do workshops for folks where, and also get into real work with folks, right, through the collaboration. So I'm always looking for, you know, people who are really ready to take that next step and really transform their classrooms, right? It's not light work. It's not easy work. Not everybody is there. But I'm really excited. You know, my goal, you know, I quote Ruha Benjamin when I talk about this. She's a formal scholar in race and technology, but, you know, she talks about the importance of viral justice. And it is in a context of a conversation about COVID. So it's a little uncomfortable, but one of the things that I like about that concept is that it doesn't matter how small, right? Small acts of justice can add up. So for me, the way I think about my work is if I can connect, the more people I can connect with, and the more can pay it forward and further that work, the more we can get this work done. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
So of course, there are all kinds of strategies that are, you know, top down, big policy changes, et cetera, that we need. We need more investment in education, of course, at all levels. You know, and we need to keep pressuring our representatives and our leaders for that. But at the same time, I think, you know, I can't just sit idly by, you know, doing the same thing. You know, I have my tenure, I'm comfortable, you know, just kick my leg, you know, put my feet up on the desk. That's where I'm at. This is actually exactly the moment for me. I have that security. This is the moment for me to get into the work and start putting that work in. And so for me, it's about connecting with folks who can do that. And it's really about thinking about the power of education beyond the sort of trite cliche. Like, we all know that education, you know, better education will lead to a better future. But I think we've said that so much that we forget what that means. We don't even know what the potential of what we are saying. So I'm talking about, let's really sit with that statement. Let's really think about the way in which education can be a powerful motor of change. And what kind of change and for whom, right? Because when I say I want to build 20th century global citizens that are ready to go out there and change the world, I mean, meet the needs of our most vulnerable global citizens, right? Right? Because there's a lot of ways to interpret that statement, but I'm telling you, work, we have an opportunity. And we are molding young minds. We have a tremendous responsibility and an opportunity. And I hope that university leaders are paying attention and listening to that too, presidents, provosts, et cetera. But I think at the end of the day, I'm really passionate about motivating faculty and educators, you know, lest we think we are disempowered. You know what I'm saying? Because of course, the forces that crush us feel very intense.
Yes.
But our classrooms are our classrooms, Bell Hooks said, right? Our classroom is a space of possibility.
Yes.
Learning is a paradise. Like, we need to connect with that work.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Learning is a paradise. So if anybody wants to get in touch with you or learn more about the Impossible Project, how will they connect with you?
It's all about the website. It's www.dahliamuller.com. There's whole page on the Impossible Project, as well as some pages that connect my research work to the project. So very much try to make that an inviting place for folks to come learn about my work and seek to get more involved. So I'll be excited to hear from you all out there.
Well, thank you so much. We wish you the best at the Impossible Project. That's DahliaMuller.com. So Dahlia, we've reached our college strategies portion of our interview and want to know what college or colleges did you attend? What were your majors, and what were your degrees? And what is that strategy you would give students to ensure that they're successful in college?
Oh, that's fantastic. Oh man, I wish your podcast was around when I was coming up. So I attended college at Yale University and graduate school for my MA and PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. At Yale University, I graduated as a history major with honors. I was also pre-med for 2 years. And I look back sometimes thinking, I wish I had stuck it out, but after C plus in chemistry, I just did not look like it was going well. I thought nobody's going to want a doctor who got a C plus in chemistry. So I went with my second love. Well, not my second love. I'd say they were parallel loves. You know, I always loved history. So I dove in there and I thought, yeah, I want that tenure track job, you know? So I went, you know, pretty much almost without interruption, I took 1 year off. I went to UC Berkeley for the program in Latin American history, which I always knew I wanted to work on Latin American Caribbean history. And I went straight through the MA and PhD there and didn't look back. I had my eyes on that tenure track job, said, I want that job security and those summers off. So it's increasingly a challenge, a commodity that's, you know, increasingly rare. So I recognize that, but I still think I would have remained, regardless of that, at Advantage dedicated to education because my heart lies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So tell us, what is that strategy you would have for students in college?
Students in college, like I said, one, find a mentor and find a sponsor. And they're not the same thing. So look them up, right? You need a mentor and a sponsor. Figure out how the system works and work it to your advantage. I'm serious. Don't be starry-eyed. I'm in college, et cetera. Like, think about how the system works. And that means, you know, come in and talk to your professor at office hours to make sure you get that FaceTime in, make sure they know who you are. You know, all of that is part of how you make sure that that you are able to excel in that system. And, you know, open your mind and don't be afraid to learn things that don't square with what you believe to be true, right? So like, this is an opportunity before you get into that daily grind of that job, 9 to 5, et cetera. You know, this is your opportunity. I know a lot of our students work as well. So I don't mean to say that you have that opportunity to explore knowledge without any constraints, but you still are in there, right? Your primary thing is doing those classes. So be curious, right? Hold yourself to a high ethical standard, but be curious and open. See that as your incubator, right? As your place where you're going to be able to grow, but don't be afraid to grow, right? Don't go in to confirm what you already know. Mm-hmm. You don't need to go to college for that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The whole thing, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So, you know, take that. That's life's gift right there.
Love that advice. Find you a mentor. Find you a sponsor. And those are two different things. So make sure you look them up, as she stated. Learn the system and then learn how to work the system. And then lastly, open your mind to new ideas and new experiences and new opportunities. Be curious because you are in college to learn. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Dahlia. We really appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Tarion Gully, theme song, NADWORKS, digital support, and of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.